This is the Bill Snead interview for July 15th, 2006.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Snead. This is Anthony Young calling.
Yes, Anthony.
Is this a good time to speak with you?
It is.
Okay, great. I tried to be punctual, so hopefully I got you at a good time.
You're right on time.
Okay, great. As I told you briefly, this book proposal that I'm working on is for Springer Praxis, which is known for publishing books that specialize in aerospace history and engineering. And so this particular book is on the development of the Saturn F1 engine and the S1C stage. And what I'd like to do is ask you some questions in context of the Saturn V program relevant to the engine and the first stage. I did see Dr. Lundquist's interview with you, and it was a good overview, but I have some more specific questions I'm sure you can answer for me.
I will try. It's been a few years, as you know. We'll see what we can do.
I am, of course, familiar with Roger Bilstein's book, Stages to Saturn.
Okay.
And I've compiled quite a library of information on the development. And what I'm trying to do is not go over material that's been covered before, but really focusing on development of the engine by Rocketdyne, and then development of the S1C stage by Boeing, and how the Saturn program office managed those two separate programs and integrate them into the total vehicle. I hope I'm hitting the marks here, but let me start with my first question here. As you were head of the Saturn V program control office, what was the stage of development for the Saturn V when you assumed your duties under Dr. Rudolph?
I believe it was around 1963.
Mm-hmm.
I could be off a little bit on that. That Dr. Rudolph and I and a few more people joined the Marshall Space Flight Center. Up until that time, we had been in NASA, but we were assigned to Dr. Joseph Shea,
yes,
who was in charge of system engineering and integration for the Apollo program. He had resident offices at the three centers, manned spacecraft centers, at Marshall,
mm-hmm,
at Johnson, and at Kennedy.
Okay.
When that office was closed down, Dr. Rudolph came to Marshall to head up the Saturn V program. Up until that time, Dr. Ernst Lange had been the head of the Saturn program. It was more than just the Saturn V. But Dr. Rudolph assumed the responsibility for the Saturn V program, and I joined the Saturn V program at the same time, and I think that was in 1963.
Okay. How did Dr. Rudolph outline what he envisioned your responsibilities to be within the program control office?
I had the responsibility for developing the schedules, the overall schedules for monitoring progress and problems associated with meeting those schedules, of course recommending corrective actions for that. The second major function was that of the budget. I had responsibility for the overall Saturn V budget planning, the receipt, distribution, and control,
mm-hmm,
of all the funds for the Saturn V program.
What were your previous experience? What was your previous experience with program budgeting?
I had been with Dr. Rudolph on the Pershing program. That was a military program,
mm-hmm,
when he was in charge of that. This was before the formation of NASA. At that time, we were a part of Dr. Von Braun's organization when he was a part of the Army. When NASA was formed, Dr. Von Braun and all of his team, except for those of us in the Persian Project Office, remained with the Army to complete the development of the Persian, the development of the program before we turned it over to operations. And I had responsibility for budgeting an element within that program.
Okay. We're talking about an order of magnitude here.
Yes, we are.
as you know better than anyone, that must have been a very daunting task, but what impresses me about the Saturn V program was that the organizational structure and program management was just outstanding. How did you face up to the task of having to budget such a mammoth launch vehicle?
Well, we certainly used a very key tool, and it was a work breakdown structure. You know, you have to break a big job down into the smaller jobs,
mm-hmm.
and kind of get your arms around the smaller jobs. So we had a work breakdown structure, which was kind of a two-tiered structure. The one that we kind of referred to as the hardware elements was comprised of the S1C stage, the S2 stage, the S4B stage,
mm-hmm.
instrument unit, vehicle GSE, F1 engines, and the J2 engine. And then we had another kind of a tier that we referred to as the functional elements. These were program control, system engineering and integration, system test,
mm-hmm.
reliability and quality assurance. So we were able then to, and of course we had, you know, for the hardware elements, which was probably 90% or more, maybe 95% of the total budget, we had technical requirements, schedules, and budgets that we established and controlled for each of those elements. And we had you know, managers for each of those hardware elements, S1C stage manager, S2, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those elements had a program control, which was kind of a well, responsible for that element, just as I was for the total Saturn V. So we worked through those managers in identifying, you know, the budgetary needs, working with them on the technical requirements, how well they were meeting the technical requirements and schedules. And, you know, my job was to issue, you know, guidelines for the preparation of the budget, which would be, you know, when we were going to launch, what vehicles when. When they had to make the deliveries, and they would then estimate their requirements, working with their respective contractors to identify budgetary needs. And I maintain an overview of that, and was responsible to Dr. Rudolph for pulling all of that together and balancing those out. If one stage, you know, was exceeding, making more progress than the other, we had to balance out the resources. My job was to make recommendations on how to make that balance.
Okay.
We also maintained a rather hefty program reserve, which Dr. Rudolph managed, and of course I took care of that for him. One of the program elements, which was referred to as a project, was in trouble, we had the means of using that reserve to kind of buy back time.
Mm-hmm.
Running behind schedule, or if we encountered particular problems, we could throw additional resources at that problem to try to recover and get it back on schedule. The big job was trying to keep everything moving along at a pace such that everything came together, you know, at a
yes.
particular time.
I understand Mr. Erlob, is it Erlob?
Yeah, Erlob,
He was manager of the S1C stage. Yeah. I do have a copy of an interview he conducted some years ago, but I believe he has passed away, is that correct?
I think he has, yes, Matt.
Okay.
He is deceased, yes.
Okay.
He had, his program control manager was William Hallisey, Bill Hallisey, H-A-L-L-I-S-E-Y. He is still living here in Huntsville and could probably provide more in-depth insight on the S1C stage per se than I can. I was overlooking all the stages, not concentrating on any one.
Okay.
So you may want to keep that in mind.
All right, I'll make a note here, and I'm sure I can find his number and contact.
If you have a problem, I can get his number for you.
All right, great. Did you have any interface at all with the prime contractors like Boeing and Rocketdyne within the program office?
No, I would say not in a direct sense.
Okay.
Directly, yes, very definitely we did. But we looked to the manager, Matt Erlob,
mm-hmm.
to be the interface with that contractor. So we respected that position on his part. So the prime interface was with him. Now, of course, we would have quarterly reviews where the prime contractor would make presentations not only to the project manager, Matt Erlob, but also members of the program staff, Dr. Rudolph's staff.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in that sense, we were getting firsthand accounts of what was going on. But on the day-to-day operation management direction of that contractor, we looked to the project manager, Matt Erlob, to do that.
Okay. In terms of program management, how were there weekly meetings to evaluate progress on the various portions of the, it wasn't just simply the launch vehicle that you were involved in, or were there other aspects such as the crawler transporter or launch umbilical tower, the launch platform, that sort of thing, or was it?
Those things were the responsibility of Kennedy Space Center.
Ah, okay.
And there was, I think, Dr. Rocco Petrone was in charge of that, all of the launch activities associated with the launch of the Saturn V. And he had a program control manager. I don't know whether you've had anyone explained to you or not, but we had a fairly unique organizational structure. I tried to describe that in the interview with Dr. Lundquist,
mm-hmm.
but we had what we call mirror image offices. Each of the three centers, KSC, Marshall, and Johnson Spacecraft Center, had identical organization structures. I shouldn't say identical, very similar organization
mm-hmm.
structures. And that was true also of the Apollo Program Office in Washington. For example, there was a Program Control Office in headquarters. There was one at each of the centers. And we, on a day-to-day basis, we as Program Control people were in constant communication with one another on how things were going, what kind of problems we were having schedule-wise or budget-wise, technical-wise. That was more on an informational basis. Now, if actions had to be taken, we would work that through the program and the project managers. We did not have the authority, if you will, to direct anybody to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
But with that communication, we kind of had our finger on the pulse of what was going on at our respective, for our counterparts. So if actions had to be taken, we had the information there that permitted us then to generate the corrective action, the proper corrective action to get things back on track.
Okay. This question is tied into what you just told me, because a lot of people researcher, writers, or just enthusiasts of the Apollo program look at the program management as a kind of model of how to really manage and move forward such a macro engineering project like that. And you just mentioned these organizational mirror structures of these organization charts, if you will. I've got the one for the MSFC Saturn V program office here in front of me, and it goes down, I think, four levels, and it's within, and of course, your program control office is listed here along with about a dozen others. What was the origin of the creation of this management structure? Because that was really the key for keeping this program on track, how to deal with problems, resolve them, move forward. Because something so this large, I don't think had ever been undertaken since probably the Manhattan Project.
No, I would have to agree with that from my limited knowledge of it. I have to give credit to Dr. George Miller for that, because we referred to those as the Miller boxes.
Okay.
So I think it must have been his idea to structure the organization that way. You know, he was the associate administrator for manned space flight.
Mm-hmm.
He had the Gemini program and the Redstone program and the Apollo program. All three were under him. And he had managers for each of those elements. Dr. Sam Phillips was the director for the Saturn V program. And I don't recall who the other for the Gemini program. And I think it was Bill Snyder, if I'm not mistaken. And then for the Mercury, let's see, Gemini, Apollo, and the other one. anyway, for the three programs, okay.
Mm-hmm, yes.
I would say Dr. George Miller would be the one.
Okay.
Now, where he came up with the idea, I do not know. I have no idea. Where that might have been used previously, if it had been, or whether, you know, it was his innovation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How often did you actually meet with Dr. Rudolph? Was it a weekly requirement, or I assume there were weekly status review meetings?
We did. We had our weekly status review meetings, let me correct that. I think it was monthly, or formal meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Was every month that we had. We had a program control center. I don't know whether you've been exposed to that or not. And that was a kind of a center which was under my responsibility for developing the center and for operation of the center. And in that center, it was patterned after one of the DOD systems that they had. So I won't say it was a novel idea, but it was unique for NASA at the time, because it was the first one we put together. Later, all of the other centers and NASA headquarters put together a similar type center. And in there we had, this was before the days of the computer.
Yes.
So we could have had so much better system, you know, with the technologies available today. But the thing that we used that was just large, I guess they must have been 5x8 plexiglass boards. And we would actually strip tape on those boards, and they were lighted from behind.
Mm-hmm.
And we had schedules in there for F1 engine, J2 engine, S1C stage, S2 stage, S4B stage, and every hardware element of the program. And then we had schedules in there for each vehicle, like the first flight article, second flight article,
mm-hmm.
so forth, and for all the ground test articles. We had no schedule if we had major test facilities, like the dynamics test facility or all vehicle systems test, 501 test. We had all of the things required to conduct that test displayed in there. And that was maintained on a current basis at all times. We required, we had a name on each chart. chart in there as to who had responsibilities for maintaining that on a real-time basis, keeping it up to date. If there were a problem, for example, if an engine delivery were late, or if the S1C stage was late on delivery, we would use a red arrow in there to identify that as a potential problem area. So for our monthly reviews, I had knowledge of everything that was in the center. Then I would put together the agenda for the monthly review, and I would make sure that on the agenda we would be addressing every major problem that had been identified, be it technical, schedule, or budget, that we would address in our monthly meetings. And we would give emphasis, of course, to the areas which, you know, were experiencing the problem. It was almost by management by exception. If things were going well, that person didn't have to speak very much.
That's right.
Our effort was on the problem areas. That's where our time was spent.
So I would guess that the input regarding the progress or any red flags regarding schedule for, say, the S1C stage or F1 engine deliveries were given to you by Matt Erlob for the first stage, or the director for the responsible for the engine. I guess that, and you would get these inputs at that time. Is that right?
That is correct. We had also in that board our problem resolution board, which identified what we considered to be, you know, the top 10 problems in the program at any one point in time.
Mm-hmm.
We had a person identified who had the responsibility for coming up with a corrective solution to that. We had a due date of when that was required, and we you know, used that as a means of tracking the resolution of each outstanding problem. And of course, as you can imagine, those subjects were always on our program review until the problem resolved and another one replaced it.
Yeah. From the program standpoint, what things stand out in your mind with regard to, or do anything stand out in your mind with regard to the first stage or the F1 engine as they relate for my book, in terms of scheduling, delivery, or anything? Was there something that really stands out in your memory?
You know, I cannot say that there was, except, you know, when we had the Pogo problem, if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
502. I guess that was the big one, but that was a tremendously smooth program, and they were able to support our stage deliveries, you know, very well. Now, I don't know whether you're aware of it or not, but the management of the engines was not under Dr. Rudolph. The management of the engines was under Lee Ballou.
Lee Ballou?
B-E-L-E-W.
Okay.
Lee Ballou. And he had an F1 manager, J2 manager, an H1 manager, and I think that was the three. There may have been another one, but that was the three principal ones for the Apollo program.
Yes.
They had their budgets. Now this is for the development of the engine.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rudolph and his managers, were responsible for budgeting of the production engines. In other words, engines that we had delivered from the engine project offices.
Okay.
We did the budgeting and the schedule. We would indicate this is when we need our engines to support our schedule deliveries. And of course, the vehicle deliveries is what determined when the engines had to be delivered. And, you know, we worked with the CAPE to understand, you know, when they had to have the vehicle in order to meet a certain launch date. We just backed up from that launch date to the delivery date of the vehicle, delivery date of the stages, and then the delivery date of the engine. Those were requirements that we imposed on the engine office, and we were in contact. They had their manager and their program control, you know, so we had daily contacts on how the engines were coming along relative to our need dates. So
okay.
That's how that worked.
Okay. And, of course, the first stage, that was built at the Saturn ones were built in Huntsville. Is that correct?
Some of the ground test articles and the first two flight articles were built at Marshall. But we had selected Boeing, and we brought Boeing in to work alongside us while the shoe plant was being, I guess, renovated.
Okay.
For the production. And then once it was ready to go, we transferred the responsibility for manufacturing the stages to the Boeing company at Michoud and their first delivery. I think they had a ground test engine in there, and they had shop queens, you know, where they would run things through to kind of check out the tooling and so forth. I don't remember exactly what ground test stages they did deliver. I know they did deliver some, but their first flight stage was 503 and all subsequent stages.
Okay. Since we're on that subject, did you have an opportunity to attend any live fire tests of the F-1 engine or the S-1C stages?
Yes, well, when I was, as observer, of course.
Yes.
We had the test stands at Marshall for both the engine and the S-1C stage.
What was your reaction to the, I assume you witnessed an S1, a full five engine cluster S1C?
Yes,
what was your response to that fire?
Well, just unbelievable. We were in an observation, I don't know what to call it, tower or whatever, location anyway. And the thing that I remember about that is the you know, the vibrations from that. Would just make your chest, you know, you could just feel the pressure on your body. My trousers would just absolutely vibrate, you know, as the test was going on.
Uh-huh.
So it was, you know, of course the sound was just unbelievable. And the thing that I enjoy about, or remember about it too, is I live about, I don't know, probably eight miles from the test stand, and the chandelier in my house would let me know when they were firing when I was not there. when we fired the S1C, the flame bucket was in a direction of a little town west of Huntsville, Decatur, which was about 20 miles away. We had to pick our days for firings because we had to have correct atmospheric conditions, or it just rained havoc on the city.
Mm-hmm.
Some 20 miles away, so we were very selective in the days that we had our firings on the full stage. The engine was not quite so critical, of course.
All right. Since I can't meet these gentlemen, perhaps you can give me your impressions of what it was like to work with Dr. Von Braun and Dr. Rudolph.
Well, I can speak more for Dr. Rudolph because I was with him from almost sun up to sundown every day.
Yes.
He was just a tremendous person to work for. I don't know whether you know about his background or not.
Let me give you a little thing real briefly here.
Right.
I am familiar with the... just briefly, his career at Marshall, but I know, I think, a bit more about the very unfortunate series of events that occurred much later, which I think it were an absolute travesty, but you and I both know what that involved.
Yeah.
But what I want to do in this book is not really address that at all.
No, I was referring more to the experience that he had.
Yes, exactly. Oh, okay, yes.
You know, he had been the manager of the Redstone program.
Okay.
Of the Pershing program, and back in Germany, of course, he was in charge of the manufacturing and production of the I don't know whether V1 or, but certainly the V2. You know,
the rockets
that were fired over. So he had a tremendous amount of experience in the actual manufacture. I mean, he was in charge, you know, hands-on manufacturing, quality control, you know, building to engineering requirements, testing, budgeting. He had done it all many times before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I recall I was a pretty young man when I, you know, when I assumed the responsibility for the Saturn V program control. And I always told him, I said, you know, it just seems that you have a sixth sense in your decision-making process. I was always impressed with how he approached, you know, problems that were encountered or planning or whatever it was we were doing, that he just seemed to you know, just know what had to be done. And it was not until, I guess, late in the program that it finally dawned on me that sixth sense that I was seeing was that of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought a tremendous amount of experience through the program. I don't think I could have done anything wrong had I tried to, because he was there overseeing, you know, not only me, but the other managers,
mm-hmm.
project managers, mm-hmm. hardware managers as well, you know, kind of overseeing that as a manager. So, I mean, he was not going to let some stupid things, that at least things that came to his attention, he was not going to let some stupid thing get by him.
Yes.
And he had that experience that he just knew, you know, what needed to be done. If we got tight on our budget, you know, the thing that he would not cut, well, the first thing he would cut would be cut engineering. I mean, he wanted the engineering complete. If something had to give, it would have to be a downstream thing, you know, like a test program or a schedule if it had to. But he would never compromise the thing that had to be done next, if I'm making sense.
Yes, you are.
If it was engineering, that is what got to the emphasis. If hardware was being built, building that hardware that was to be delivered tomorrow got the emphasis, not the one that had to be delivered day after tomorrow. And everything was done, you know, with just excellence for the things that had to be done today. Now, of course, the things downstream were impacted somewhat by this decision.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we used our reserves then for bailing ourselves out of problems as we went downstream. And he dealt with that, and you know, all you know, with whether it was dealing with budget matters, schedule matters, or technical matters. I mean, he dealt with them all in a like manner.
Okay.
Yeah, but he was really a pleasure to work with. He was one who also would give you as much rope as you could take. He was not.
He gave you the responsibility.
Pardon?
He gave you the responsibility.
He gave us the responsibility, mm-hmm. and he gave us the opportunity to execute. You know, when people would come in to our program control center for briefings, whether they, you know, were people from NASA headquarters, program office up there, or Dr. Webb, who was in charge of NASA, paraded I don't know how many people through that program control center. Dr. Rudolph always had me giving the briefings. He did not do it. So, I mean, he would just... You know, he was good to let you
mm-hmm.
have the responsibility and also to get, you know, your credit or your knocks if things did not go well. He delegated well, and I had a tremendous relationship with him. I just could have asked for a better person. With Dr. Van Braun, of course, we briefed him, you know, periodically, like on a monthly basis. And I guess as I'm recalling back now, we had our Saturn briefings were on a weekly basis. I think I told you earlier, it may have been a monthly basis, but they were on a weekly basis with Dr. Van Braun with the center, where all the laboratory directors and the program, all the program offices presented to Dr. Van Braun and his staff once a month, an all-day time meeting. And then every quarter, we would meet with the headquarters program office for a similar time briefing.
I see.
So I had opportunities to be and observe, you know, Dr. Van Braun in all of those meetings, and of course in meetings, special meetings they had where we were dealing with particular problems. I mean, these weekly, monthly, quarterly reviews were just routinely scheduled things, as you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
just progress and problem type thing. But any time a particular problem came up, it had to be dealt with. You know, we would have meetings of the appropriate people. Many times Dr. Van Braun would be involved in those to brief him on the type of problem. If we had, for example, a stage blow-up, you know, we had some stages to go on the test stand.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, very major. And very clearly we had meetings with the center director and his staff on what the problems were and what the implications of it was and what our recovery plans were and that kind of thing. But he was a tremendous man. I guess I would have to put him at the top of my list of anybody I ever, you know, interfaced with in terms of his balanced engineering knowledge. He was a visionary, politician. He was about all of it wrapped into one, a true leader, without a doubt. And a very very compassionate man. He dealt with the people very gently. He could pound the table when he had to, and he did on a number of occasions. But he was he's a real gentleman. You know, I did not fear going before him at all. I felt I had to be prepared. But he was, you know, just a fine person to interact with.
That's great. I actually just finished an article for the Space Review, remembering Wernher von Braun, because he passed away on June 16th in 1977, and I didn't find a single article in any newspaper or on any news website. So I wrote this thing, and if you give me your email address later, I'll give you the link so you can read it. But I'm 56, so all of my memories of him are simply whatever I saw on television or have read in books. And I think it's important to get a personal response from someone who worked with him, because another article I wrote some last year was called The Legacy of Great Men. And it's always been my contention that the Apollo program had an extraordinary assemblage, if you will, of completely competent and brilliant people working on the program, that if, and maybe at the top, if half a dozen of these had chosen another profession, the Apollo program might have been much different, or realized much later than it actually was. That's just my personal opinion, but it was just an extraordinary...
I think I would put some in that category, but, you know, I wouldn't put all. I wouldn't put myself in that category. I think many people could have done the job, and I think there were other positions of a like manner, but the synergism of the whole organization, I think, contributed mightily to the success of the program. As I said, you know, with people like Von Braun, Dr. Rudolph, Dr. Miller, Dr. Phillips, the people I do put in that category now, you know, it could make a good man out of an average man, a manager, I should say, not a man.
I understand. Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
and,
I do understand.
I think in my case, I was not prepared. I was not equipped. I was not qualified to do the job that I had. But you know, with Dr. Rudolph, who did know what that was all about, you know, I had some good advice and oversight from him on how to do it.
I think that's a mark of an excellent manager too.
Because I think it is too.
In terms of delegating, but also in giving instruction and direction.
That's right. That's exactly right. Because you can't do it all yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I was not short on hard work or long hours. I mean, a 14-hour day was a standard day for me.
Yeah.
After a short period of time, I assumed responsibility for the configuration management function, and that was a huge job. And that was, you know, keeping up with all your technical requirements and, levying those requirements on the managers, tracking the progress, you know, against the requirements as to how they were doing on weight and performance and so forth. And, you know, with most everything translates into one of those three things. Any problem, you know, anything, you know, requires dollars. So somehow or other, I had my little grubby fingers on about everything that went on. And schedule-wise, the same way, the least little hiccup, you know, would perturbate its way right up into into the engine or into a stage. And from the stage, it'd go into a launch vehicle. When it got into the launch vehicle, of course, it became my business.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to run the trial out back. So, but he did, Dr. Rudolph. Now, he, unlike Dr. Von Braun, he was a low-key guy. You know, he referred to himself often as a blacksmith. And, you know, Von Braun was the suave, charismatic, you know, guy who could speak to, and did speak with presidents on down, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rudolph was an entirely different personality. Guy that just got his satisfaction out of staying in his office, working and getting the job done, you know.
Yes.
He was not one to go to the press and, you know, conduct interviews. He did, but that wasn't his thing.
Okay. Where can you tell me where the program control? Where was the program control office located in terms of the buildings within the complex? I'm not sure of was there a main headquarters building or?
Yes, at Marshall, we are all located in building 4201.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Bud Brown building, which housed most of the I guess you would call it operating systems, your facilities office, comptroller's office was over there, public affairs, I mean those kind of offices. We had two buildings back of that main headquarters building, 4201 and 4202, where the program offices were located. And all of the Saturn program and engines, F1, J2 engines, were located in 4201. Dr. Rudolph was, Dr. Rudolph reported to a director of industrial operations, and during most of that Apollo program, General O'Connor,
mm-hmm.
on assignment from the Air Force, was responsible for overseeing all of the programs. He reported directly to Dr. Van Brand, Dr. Rudolph, Leland Ballou, and Lee James, who was the S-1B stage manager, reported to General O'Connor. They were on the sixth floor, and I was on the third floor of that building.
Of the main building, or 4201?
No, of 4201.
Okay.
4201, that's the building I'm at. It was a six-story building.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, of course, we were all right there. I mean, it was a matter of walking down the hall or up a floor, to interface with your counterpart. So it was...
Okay.
We were not scattered all over the center.
Within your program control office, how many did you have in working in your department or office? Was it a small group?
I'm going to have to guess a minute, but I think I had about, probably around 30 or 35 people, something like
mm-hmm.
that. It wasn't an overly large office.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had, I had some support contractors who assisted with the configuration management function, and I guess we must have had 60 or 80 Boeing people involved in that, and then I also had them in assisting with the scheduling activity and the operation of that program control center, and I guess there was probably another 40 or so people there. That group. Now, they were not located in our building. They were located elsewhere, but they provided support for the activity.
Oh, I see.
The people who helped maintain that program control center, we did have them located in the building.
Mm-hmm.
But we tried to build a wall between, contractors and ourselves. The history on that, I won't bother going into it with them, but we could not treat them as another employee.
Exactly.
We had to treat them as a contractor, and therefore kept distance between ourselves and them to make sure that, they weren't sitting in a chair next to a civil servant person.
Yes. Okay. What would you say were your most vivid memories of your work during that Saturn V program? And the bulk of it, of course, was all during, I guess, right around the mid-60s, from the early to, 63 to 68, I guess. I'm not sure. You'd have to give me the time span.
Yeah, I was with the program office until we had made deliveries of most of our, vehicles. And after that, the challenge had kind of left it, and we had formed a new business organization, and I elected to leave. Actually, before the lunar landing program, of course, the hardware had already been delivered, and
mm-hmm.
I didn't have much to do with the CAPE operations. the stacking of the vehicles and checking it out. As far as memories, and I'm not sure exactly what you're searching for there.
You may have answered the question in a manner of speaking in some other ways, but
let me answer one. And of course, the thing that I think I got, I guess, some of the greatest satisfaction out of was in developing, you know, the schedule, pulling all of the pieces together. You know, just take 501 for example. Well, to have a 501 schedule, we had to have ground tests done for, you know, stacking the vehicle with dynamics testing. We had structural testing of a vehicle. We had stage testing. We had engine testing. I mean, we had many, many, many things that had to be done, you know, leading up to that. Developing we used a per-type logic network to get all of the interfacing elements, you know, things that had to be done before something else could be done. All of those, putting all that architecture together, you know, starting with a stage with an engine, and then pulling the S1C first flight stage with the S2 flight stage with the S4B and the instrument unit, the vehicle GSC, all the software that had to be developed, all that had to be brought together, and that was a tremendous challenge and a very satisfying thing.